Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. Don't forget, we don't owe that debt. When somebody assumes authority, when somebody gets their hands on your checkbook and starts writing checks, and even though those checks may be clearing and everything else is happening, that is all fraud. And as a matter of fact, by law, you should be able to get every penny back. Now, when we look at what we need to do, we need to form a movement. This is like the Martin Luther Reformation movement, but we're not reforming, we're reclaiming. The law still exists. The government that we have is still legitimate, but those who are occupying our legitimate government have instituted and are exercising powers not granted and exercising roles, responsibilities, and all sorts of things that they don't have the authority to do. And they're spending money on things that they don't have the authority to do, which means that we have to basically wipe all of these things out. It's not like we have to go in there with a wrecking crane. It's all of a sudden the funding stops. All of a sudden the states, by interposition, will force the federal government to actually stop doing things they don't have. EPA, you're done. You're gone. The EPA goes back to the states. And the states will actually have to implement their own. If they want to, they will. If they think, now here's the thing. Welcome back, Sean, because I'm in a rat hole that I'm going to be explaining some things to kind of help. Because we're actually reading this part of the Constitution where the states are constrained from being able to create an alliance, right, or a confederation. Is that not correct?
That is correct, sir.
Okay, so the Constitution forbids them to do that. But the framers never envisioned that government would be very involved in the day-to-day lives, even at the state and county level, other than basic crime, you know, rules of the road, those types of things. But when as we have grown with technology, with infrastructure, all sorts of things that have kind of contributed to where, let's just look at it this way. In America, we want to embrace and utilize and empower the free market as much as possible, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so how much free market do we have in our utilities?
None.
But we actually play this game, and we've actually thrown common sense, logic, and reason to the side, and we've actually handed over what we built unconstitutionally by the federal government, what FDR did by started to create the American grid, same thing with the highways and all these other things. And so when we look at the fact that we created this system, and then every state started handing it off to corporations that have a monopoly. And, oh, well, they have to behave a certain way. But the fact is, how many of these fat cats are walking home with millions of dollars every year? I know Avista, the CEO for Avista, makes $20, $30 million a year off of their profits. And that's just the CEO. There is, you know, they've got these targets and these awards, or what we say, these bonuses or these pays that they get if they can save money. Everybody goes, well, how do we have a grid that's so vulnerable? Because we moved it into a profit base. So bottom line, that line in the Constitution actually has to go away, that the states can form, if all of the states in the continental United States, because like with Alaska, it's going to be Alaska by themselves, right? Because we don't have a direct connection to Alaska, so they won't be a part of the grid for infrastructure. It's the same thing if states in the EU join America over, you know, the next 50 years or however long it takes for states to finally wake up and say, we want to become a part of that system, then they will have to start creating their own when they start creating a contiguous or continuous connections with each other to where it is no longer certain things. If you can't have a free market, I can't envision every minute of the day where you can literally flip a switch and start buying electricity and start receiving that electricity from a different provider at any point in time. This is the same thing with water.
Streaming.
Pardon me?
Like streaming.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. If you're streaming content, that means you've signed up for a subscription. Folks, if we actually did this, if we went down this path, because look at who gets the most disposable income from us. The energy companies. That is they consider that disposable income. And actually, it shouldn't be that way. They shouldn't be making that kind of money. I mean, it's kind of like cell phone companies. Look at the profits these companies are making. Now, I'm not trying to, you know, out everybody as bad people, but I have a hard time thinking that our communication system is even a legitimate communication system just due to the fact that the regulations are just a facade. The regulations protect the cell phone companies from bombarding us with bad emissions that are affecting our health, and they're not being held accountable the same way the pharmaceutical companies aren't being held accountable for the damage they're doing to us. This is why the federal government was never granted, and Madison literally said this, and I think it was in the Federalist Papers where he said this specifically, that if you really look at the federal government's focus was to be external. On external matters, ensuring, you know, the regulation of trade with foreign nations for our national security and defending ourselves and having a national defense system. Those types of things, their job was to protect the sovereignty of the union and the independent sovereignty of the states. We kind of even have gone through the ratification debates and proved that the states, because they were different, the federal government was not to homogenize the union. They didn't have any authority to change any state. Let's get this. In Why Counties Matter Most, I lay out the fact of how the federal government reached into every state in the union and literally reconfigured them into democracies by basically saying you can't have county governments as a basis of your state. You have to have basis of your state legislation and representation, that you have to have legislative districts based on population, which means that they completely wiped out your counties. Folks, if you haven't read that document, it's Sean, have you read it?
I have read most of it, sir.
I'm not looking for a glowing review. As a matter of fact, I let me warn everybody. It is thick, it's deep, and it's not written for sixth grade level comprehension. I'm not here to write and sell a lot of books. But if you want the facts, then that's what you're going to get from my articles. And so, did you garner some of that stuff out of that?
Absolutely, sir.
Okay. So
I use it as a reference for a lot of things.
There you go. So, as a matter of fact, I actually got a review in San Diego from a San Diego publisher that reviewed my very first book, and her comment was that that first book is what she would use as her textbook for teaching American history, because what I cover in that book are all very integral things that people must understand, you know, the makeup, the composition, how we evolve, that type of thing. And so, because we're not taught that. We're not taught any of that. So with that, as we look at the Avista, we look at the water, we look at even the highways. When we look at infrastructure, you just can't, you know, decide, I want to use their highway instead of my highway. You know, and there's this independent thought of the sovereign national, the state national, sovereign citizen, what have you. where the concept is, hey, they can't make something that's a right and then charge you to use it. If it's, you don't have a right to use the road. Now, you have a right to travel, right? You have a right to go from point A to point B. Here's your problem. Back in the old days, property wasn't used, or not all property was purchased. And the common areas that most people traveled through was just open land that nobody purchased, nobody developed, what have you. Or they kind of allowed you to traverse their property. But it's their property, right? And if they don't want you to, you know, be using their property for a thoroughfare for you to, you know, take your wagon and stir up dust, or today to drive your car without a muffler or whatever, then that's their property, which is why they created a road system. Now, this is the truth. This is the facts that we'll find. When you go into the state constitutions, the people never granted and delegated to the state the ability to regulate the transportation. It's just not there. They don't have the ability to create and establish roads, establish waterways. It's not there because it was just being done. People, you kind of all agreed that and when somebody bought property, it says, hey, you can't be coming through here anymore. Then guess what they did? They changed the course and went around the property. And so that caused, you know, a little winding here, winding there. And as a matter of fact, if you ever drive through some areas, very rural areas, and you find all of a sudden the road takes a bend, and there's no reason, it's not a river or anything else, it bends and drives out, and then it comes and then bends back and then goes straight again. There's a good likelihood that that bend was caused because a property owner said, I don't want you to use my property for a road. And it's property rights. And so when these arguments just fly off the state nationals to say, you can't make me have a driver's license. You can't create standards. Absolutely they can. But they don't have the authority per the Constitution to do it. But who else would do it? Right? I mean, if you think about it, do we really want to tear up the roads and then try to figure out how we're going to get from here to there? No. As civil society works together, they discipline, they figure out what is necessary. And that's one of the beautiful things that the Constitution actually allows and accounts for. Even when it comes to private property, no private property can be seized by government without just compensation. We'll get that in the Fifth Amendment. And we'll prove how what just compensation really is, because nobody gets just compensation. So back to my obligatories. It is all about demanding compliance of the Constitution. And the only way we're going to get there, and the only way we're going to finally get to a point where we're really, you know, doing the right things. We don't need these leagues and leagues. Let me ask you, have you traveled, Sean? Have you ever traveled to Europe?
Yes, I have.
Have you been?
Years in Germany.
There you go. So you've been on the Autobahn.
Yes, I have.
How old is the Autobahn?
I think it was developed during World War II, right? Or before it.
Yes, actually building up to World War II before we got involved in it. Yes, it was prior to our engagement in it. But it was a part of Hitler's, you know, making Germany great again.
Right.
So as we look at the Autobahn, how much of the Autobahn has been, how much of the original Autobahn is intact?
When I was there, it was pretty extensive.
Pretty extensive, and it was growing as well. The Autobahn is still kind of growing as, you know, the needs of, you know, moving, you know, commerce to flow and so forth. And here's the interesting thing, folks. I mean, look at how old it is, and they built that thing to last. Why would we build roads and highways as a throwaway thing? Why would we create a highway and say, you know what, we just want to build it to this standard, so we have to replace it in 8 years? That's a great expense, right?
Right.
I remember when we were doing projects and so forth, one of the biggest costs that is associated to any project, especially a project where they've got, you know, this type of, you know, involvement of labor. Labor is always the most expensive. Material and the property, whatever, that's all it's in the sauce. The labor costs, and if you actually did it right once and spent a little bit more on material, you would never have to come back and replace that highway. And down the road, when you had to add to it and adjoin to it, because isn't that what they did with the Audubon? They came right next to it and added more lanes, and they were able to basically tie these things together without compromising the integrity of the old and adjoin to the new. And do you know how thick that concrete is?
Oh, it's amazing what they do. And I was hoping I have a chance to comment, because we used to see them doing construction. And the way they do construction is so much different than we do here. They would build a whole new section of road on the side, and you'd be driving past it every day, and it would never impede the traffic or cause any kind of inconvenience. And then once they had that auxiliary road built, then they would redirect the traffic onto it, and then they'd repair the original part.
Right.
It was like seamless.
Right. And so, and that was probably just a temporary road at that, right?
Correct, yeah. And still better than what we have.
Right, absolutely. And sometimes they would use that temporary road as an ancillary or an arterial. Because, I mean, have you been to Dallas?
Yes.
So Dallas has roadways that parallel the highway, right? And they become the perfect thing for rerouting if necessary for, you know, doing highway work. So anyway, I mean, when you start thinking and you really try to solve the problem of how can we do this so that we don't have to come back and do this again and again and again and again and again. And if you add up how many times, if you just look at the, you know, a strip of, you know, I-5, or 95, right? I think 95 goes down from Florida up to Maine. So if you look at how much it costs to create that highway from that point to that point, and how many times we've done it every time, the cost of creating and maintaining that in comparison to actually have done it right. The other thing that's amazing is the weather, because it gets freezing cold over there. It gets hot. So it had to be able to deal with and sustain the temperature changes as well. So anyway, so it kind of goes down this path of, you know, if the states actually, because they're the ones that have to pay this. The reason why we've become a throwaway society is because the next group, because this is all partisan, they may have control, and when the Democrats create a road project, all unconstitutionally, they'll throw it to the labor unions that favor them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the Republicans don't have many labor unions that favor them. So they have to kind of say, well, you know, what are you going to give us? You know, try to create those types of compromises, you know, and good luck in holding people accountable. But there's always these, you know, give and trades. Now, when it comes to infrastructure, when we look at some of the infrastructure projects, we've talked trillions of dollars. Obama spent almost $1 trillion throughout his presidency on infrastructure, almost, if not more than. And one of those big budget items was to create fast, high-speed internet for everybody. Now, that night right there is not a union gig, per se, because it's more of tech companies, right? I don't know many tech companies that have, you know, labor union involvement and so forth and going out and, you know, they may be construction and laying fiber and so forth, but that gets to a level of technicality that I'm not sure if the union is involved in those guys. Do you know?
I don't think so. I know one of my neighbors works in that field, and they just had a labor disagreement, and they ended up all having to go to different companies because they had no leverage. So I would think not.
Okay, so there you go. Because what he did was he ran fiber, and what ended up happening out of the expenditure of all of that, and that's how he was able to throw money out to groups that were just kind of sitting and waiting. It was kind of very similar to Solyndra and Kaiser and these other people with the alternate energy, those bills that he threw out, and stimulating solar and stimulating windmill energy production and so forth. He threw out all sorts of billions of trillions of dollars were thrown away by him by actually putting money into the hands of those who supported him to ensure they had enough money to support him in his recoming, his next election. Now, Clinton did the very same thing. Everybody did the same thing. All the way back to, I think, Andrew Jackson was the guy that really started using the, they called the spoil system, using government and some government expenditure to put money back into the hands of those who helped support your campaign. This is when we became corrupt in working with business. It was at that point in time that the direction or the course of the nation was heading towards a marriage of business and corporations. This is why corporations receive personhood from the government, because that's what they wanted. They wanted to have more power, more ability to get involved in political things. And so that they had to become a person. So the court made him a person, right? So, it's not that the court had the authority to do that. All of these things were basically interpretations. All of these things were overreaches either by the court or by the federal government, so on and so on and so on. But anyway, I digress. I was really in the opening here to kind of help get back to what we were talking about, because it all goes down to this. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation. That's where we left off. And so I believe that if we want to have a national energy strategy of what's best for us, then the federal government can't be involved, because they've proven that they're not doing what's best for us. They've actually supported and sustained OPEC when OPEC formed. OPEC became a hostile entity to what we needed and what, you know, we were trying to do with our own businesses and so forth. There was a lot of, you know, I'll just say hyperbole, but I think Ayn Rand, she was making some very good points. And we went into some of these countries and we had all the technology. And when we walked away, they basically, we left that stuff in their hands. And they were able to re-engineer it. We should have said, no, we're going to operate. We're going to control this. This is our intellectual property. You want to get that stuff out from underneath your feet? Then you either figure out how to do it yourself, or you can, you know, pay us and we will take care of that for you. Does that make sense? That was Ayn Rand's argument in the 60s when OPEC started to form. And when everybody says, hey, you're stealing our property. Well, no, we actually came in. You're making a lot of money off of this, and that's not fair, right? Oh, it comes down to that we weren't being fair. And I get it. I understand that, you know, corporations were making a lot of money. Right, wrong, or indifferent, we, the government, shouldn't have been involved in any of those things, the federal government, in the first place. But all that being said, let's move on to B. Section 1, or subsection 10, section, subsection 1, letter B.
The state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but,
That's okay, so I have it. So I'll just go ahead and read it because I got it broken down. So the second one is grant letters of marque and reprisal. So in other words, that right there is kind of acting as piracy and actually warfare and those types of things, to where, you know, we, the state, would be able to go after and target a foreign entity. Now, we're going into break, so when we come back, we'll talk about why states can't do that, and then we'll get into these other ones, because these other ones, that first one is a real difficult one. Most people don't understand that's important for us to be able to do. But we still have to have a limitation of keeping the states out from foreign engagements and so forth. But anyway, we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So I kind of think it goes without saying that when we look at that one line, that no state shall enter into any treaty or alliance or confederation, we can kind of see today that we've matured to a point where our state government needs the ability to create alliances amongst themselves. In other words, and this goes back to what I was going to say yesterday, or actually earlier, is that when we look at the federal government being outward facing, that not to be involved in domestic matters, it should be left to the states. I mean, it should not be done with, well, these other nations want us to compromise and not do these things so that we can't make that kind of money. Giving that power to the federal government is why they've been suppressing us and conducting warfare against us. They don't have the authority to do those things. And I say that when we get into Article 6, I will prove that they didn't have the authority to compromise what we should have been protecting ourselves. That was their obligation, to protect our sovereignty. So what we need to do is that needs to change, but we still need to have the restrictions on states regarding direct foreign engagement. We need to be able to congress or create confederations and or councils, whatever you want to call it. And I don't like the word confederation. But when it comes to infrastructure, and I wrote about this in my first book, that when you look at education, should we have national standards? Should we, you know, be working together as states on our education system? Absolutely, but the federal government shouldn't be involved in it at all. Therefore, the states would then have to kind of create this council, this education council, and or the sciences and education, whatever. And that way, they would, you know, be able to create standards and make sure that all of the states, instead of having states, you know, pitting against each other, all of the states being able to benefit. It's the same thing with infrastructure, the same thing with maybe energy. These types of things that the federal government has assumed regarding what we would call domestic matters, housing. Do we really want housing standards to be unified across the nation? I don't think so. I don't think that's a good idea. Same thing with labor. I don't think so. So I think some of these things would actually fall by the wayside. But I think some of these things where it's integral across all states, energy and that grid, same thing with infrastructure. Is infrastructure and energy the same thing? That's a good question. Is infrastructure and energy the same thing, Sean?
No.
There you go. Okay, because when we start talking, because we actually see states making plays on telling their citizens that you can't have an electric or you can't have a gas combustion engine after 2030 or 2035, whatever. Now that's right there is an ex post facto law and or bill of attainder, right? We've kind of talked that they can't do those things. And when we give the state the ability to decide what we're going to consume or use, it's kind of like the same thing when you build your home. Can the state actually come and say, you can't use natural gas or you can't generate? The states are actually making laws, like the state of Washington has been trying to go down the path of regulating themselves out of hydroelectric energy. We have a surplus of electricity via our hydroelectric energy production. Oh, but they want to actually, you know, get rid of all the dams so that the fish can flow freely, where we've actually created locks and steps and so forth to account for the movement of fish going upstream and so forth so that they've been able to spawn naturally. But that's still not good enough because it doesn't place a greater dependency on crappy energy. They want to actually get the state of Washington, like Texas, dependent on, you know, alternative energy. They want to do this to every state of the union. That shouldn't be driven from external, or I should say international forces, because this is what you were talking about before. And I don't know if we were on the air when you're talking about the World Health Organization, when you were talking about the World Economic Forum. They're trying to create policies and driving them into the states. The World Economic Forum, World Health, they shouldn't have a foot in America. The only reason that they are here is because Bill Gates is paying their way.
And the rest of us are paying too.
Yeah, the corporations, all of these rich people. So are the monarchs of today, because are basically when we look at corporations, they have arisen themselves into becoming the kings of the world, this new class of monarchs. And it's a class of families that have kind of been around for a long time. There's a lot, you could spend a lot of time going down the rat hole of this, the conspiracies and everything else. The fact of the matter is the divine hand of providence knew what we would be going through. And he gave us a constitution that was so doggone fitting, and it was so insightful, so provident, that we would be able to directly undo everything that they've been doing. Because instead of actually getting the people's, you know, or I should say getting amendments to the Constitution, because the amendments come from the states, but instead of actually properly changing and altering the Constitution via the amendment process, what they have been doing, what they literally have been doing, is they've been violating the Constitution left and right. And so in so doing that, they have literally made it so easy for us to undo and just wipe away everything that they have done. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I was just looking at the funding, the federal funding for the United Nations and the WHO, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and the WHO, actually, if you read the petition on the health freedom, I included where the funding came from. The primary contributor to the WHO, the person that spends the most amount of money, is Bill Gates. The United States is the second. In other words, the United States is taking tax dollars, your tax dollars, and giving it to the World Health Organization. They have no authority to do that.
$1.28 billion.
There you go.
Over 1 year.
Yes. So, folks, that's the immenseness. That's the magnitude of tyranny that we're being overshadowed by. And, you know, we think that they can crush us, but we have, it's almost like the Constitution is, I equate this to the immune system. The immune system can go and heal the body without killing the body. In other words, we don't have to kill our government to overthrow it. We have everything we need to hold those operators, those public servants who are violating it and created all these unconstitutional things. Now, granted, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be upset because they're going to have to move. They're going to have to move away from the most elite housing development areas in the United States outside of the D.C. area and go back to the states. Because, I don't, you know, most people don't realize that the District of Columbia has never had a downturn in its economy, really, and in any respect to what we've experienced over the past several decades. Why? Because the money still flows there. People are still getting work, and they're still, I mean, they have not been hit by any recessions. Now, if I think, let's shut down the government for a year. Let's let this thing happen. Right? That's where we're at right now. And if because I have no idea if they're going to pass it or not, because this is, let me see, this is Thursday's show, right? Yeah, this is Thursday's show. So at this point, are they still in negotiations of getting the government to? I think if you shut it down, there's going to be people who are going to be losing their homes.
I just saw a report today that they had 100,000 people resign from federal agencies.
Yeah, so the question is, was that voluntary, or was one of those things that they go, you know what, the writing's on the hands, they're going to get rid of us anyway.
Right.
Right.
I think that's what it was. And a lot of it is politically motivated because they want to try to put pressure on different points in the system and hope that the people will respond.
Right. I think when people, if the people are informed of the illegitimacy on all of these things that they're paying for, that they're doing to us, just the coronavirus itself was created by people, and we paid for it.
Right.
If people don't understand...
A lot of people learned... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think a lot of people learned a very hard lesson during COVID about the overreach of the government.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it still has not motivated them to get more tactically involved because the parties themselves are corrupt. But they don't see that there's a mechanism, and it's in the Constitution. Folks, this is why these First Amendment petitions drive your county commissioners or supervisors or parish. What are they called in Louisiana? I've been talking to you. What do you call them?
Parishes.
Okay, they're parishes instead of counties, but we have legislators in the counties, and they're either a commissioner or a supervisor. What do you have as a legislator in your parishes?
Council members.
Council members. Okay, so council members. There you go. Kind of like a city council member, but it's for the parish. Now, the parishes are made up of wards, not districts, correct?
I believe so.
Okay, because many counties, when you break down the county themselves, they have subdivide them by districts. And that's all done by population so that when they decide who, you know, how many representatives in the legislative body of the county they'll have, it'll be one person for each district. Now, sometimes you may have four districts where you break it down to four districts where, you know, that's an appropriate number for representation. What they usually do is they create a fifth, which would be an at-large, to ensure that you had a tiebreaker to make sure that nothing came to a deadlock between two and two. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The point that I'm trying to make is that the parishes have their own legislators, and technically, if you go to the Enabling Act of Louisiana, the state of Louisiana was created by the delegates out of the parishes that went to the convention, and I don't know where that convention was. Maybe it was in Baton Rouge. And they said, okay, this is going to be the capital, and here's the Constitution for the state of Louisiana. What's interesting is that at that point in time, how much of Louisiana was really in the hands of people that understood our Constitution? Do you know?
No, I do not.
Because I think most of the people that had resided there until we purchased it, it was, help me out here, I'm pretty sure it was in the hands of the French, but the French obtained it from the Spaniards, right?
Correct.
How long did the French have it? Because this is a history I don't know.
I'm not sure, but they had always been more of a mixture, and It was more of an outpost. So a lot of the things that, like the official government things. It kind of had a laissez-faire type of government until the United States took over as a territory, and then they put governors in place, and that's when they started trying to enforce things. That's when they started having issues with the people.
Right. So we went through this year. I covered the Louisiana Purchase Treaty, and it identified that both Spain would enjoy a certain period of time with free trade within that state, as well as France. And so some of those things they did that, yeah, they didn't have the authority to do that, but anyway, they did it in a treaty, and it's already done. The water's past the bridge. Well, it's out commingled into the ocean. Oceans is that far out because it's been that long ago. But the point is that both Spain and France were recipients of advantages out of that treaty, because I think they both still had, like you said, this hold. They had a shared hold on the port or the city of Louisiana and that territory that France had claimed, because we bought all that territory from France.
Right. And Spain still had Florida and that area along the Gulf Coast, because actually just north of us, the eastern part of the state and the toe of the boot wasn't part of that deal. We got that. That ended up being an independent nation, kind of like Texas. And then they ended up joining the state.
Right, right. And actually, when the Louisiana Purchase was going down, a former vice president, Aaron Burr, ran down to Louisiana and tried, you probably know about this in the history, tried to get an insurrection to get Louisiana to revolt and break away from the Union.
I did not know about that.
And Aaron Burr was tried for treason, because the charge, Thomas Jefferson being the president and having Aaron Burr do exactly what he was doing, charged him with treason. It literally was treason, and dragged him back into, I think it was Norfolk, where the trial was held. And John Marshall went down and was the judge of the trial. And there was evidence that if you look at the why Byrd didn't get charged, it was all because politically, John Marshall didn't like Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson had no respect for Alexander Hamilton. And there was this huge feud that embroiled from the very beginning. They had kind of a questionable relationship, but Jefferson gave Hamilton, because he was a civil man, he gave him the credit and latitude, and actually, you know, gave Hamilton an ear and helped Hamilton get his way on one thing. And then when the final shoe dropped, and we'll get into this when we're all done with the Constitution, that's when Jefferson realized this is a man that cannot be trusted. This is a man that has no scruples. And he, you know, he's the epitome of moral turpitude. And he was dubbed in his correspondence back and forth with Madison as the creature. So, I mean, you could tell that he just really didn't like this guy because of what he did and how he was used. Because Alexander Hamilton successfully used Jefferson to get what he wanted, so that everybody kind of got a little win on this, so that Hamilton could institute the National Bank. And the way it was done was absolutely a violation of the Constitution, on and on and on. So anyway, let me get back into track here. Let's get back onto the Constitution and Article 1, Section 10, Subsection C, coining money. Most people think that states can coin money. Because in this long phrase of enter into a treaty, grant letters of marque, coin money, they just lose that. Those two words, no state shall coin money. In other words, they won't have a Colorado, a Wyoming dollar. You can't have a currency. The only currency of coin, and or they can't even emit bills of credit either, because that's the next line. Coin, money, or emit bills of credit. So that means that they had to become a part of the financial system that the federal government was going to create and maintain. The reason why we covered in the ratification debates, because the states were constantly creating their own and inflating the currencies. They would just start printing more and more, creating more and more. Now, had they actually been coining instead of gold, you know, like slugs or steel or whatever, whatever's a common metal, next thing you know, they would have inflated that as well. And the whole point of the Constitution maintaining a precious metal meant that the value was, one, going to be very limited because there was only so much gold. There's only so much silver. Now people say, well, there's a lot more silver, but that's okay. It's the same thing with palladium. The Constitution enjoins gold and silver, but when they created the first Bank Act, they realized that they needed to have a different denomination for the smaller changes, because not everything was going to be a golden coin. You couldn't, you know, buy a cigarette for a golden coin. That would buy a whole plug for, you know, a big, huge vat or whatever those things were of tobacco, maybe a golden coin, because that was the value of gold at that point. So they injected in the very first Bank Act a copper coin for a sub-denomination. I think they injected finally the quarter, dime, nickel, and penny, and it all had to be precious metal. When the federal government started injecting just basic ore, what have you, crap metal, that's when they had the ability to inflate our currency. And in the olden days in Rome and other nations, the way they inflated their currency, they would start minting pure gold coins. And then over time, they would actually, when they bring the coins back in, what the crown would do is the crown would basically remint those coins by taking maybe half the coins and putting them into bars for the king to have. And then the other coins were mixed with, you know, an alloy or a metal that would mix with the gold, and they would mint these gold, you know, coins, and it would still look like a gold dollar, but its value, its amount of gold, was less. That's how they devalued and inflated their currency. It's just like printing money. It's just a little bit more difficult to do with minting than it is with printing. But back in those days, they didn't even have printing presses, so they had to use minting. Anyway, this next one is a big one, because this talks about what you can use for the legal tender for the payment of debt in a state. And it says, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. So in other words, they can't make a law allowing digital currency to be used as legal tender for the payment of debt. They can't use checks, credit cards, electronic. It has to be gold and silver. Are we in compliance with that?
Absolutely
not. Absolutely not. And this is why our property values have gone down dramatically. This is why inflation is killing us. Folks, we still have a way to get back. We just need to get back. And the sooner we get back, the less painful it would be. I mean, I remember if you've ever read Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, he really lays this argument out that the elixir is always going to be less harmful than not doing, you know, fixing the problem. The elixir is going to fix the problem. Not doing anything, we're going to collapse. And losing everything is far greater than having to go through a little time of austerity. Right? When everybody's lost everything, you know, people are going to die either way, possibly, because somebody may starve or what have you. But it's going to be minimalized. And as a matter of fact, because we can, you know, rally together in communities and so forth and help each other, then I see that that's the far better way to go. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the area that I live in, people live that way a lot more than in, like, the more in the cities, because I'm in the suburbs right on the edge of Cajun country. And those people down there still basically live the way they did 100 years ago. I mean, they have a lot of conveniences and stuff, but I think rural people are going to do much better because of their sense of community as things get worse. And what you were talking about with fixing the problem is going to cause pain and suffering, but the problem just keeps getting worse if you don't do something to actually fix it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you're on this little forklift that you thought was just a, you know, 6-foot forklift, but it's actually a lift that can go up, 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 up. And we're at a point where we can still survive the drop. We can still survive. We can always survive the drop. We can always survive the drop. But the embracement of getting to the level where we were taken off of that and then we're completely strapped into a new form of government, there's no surviving that. There's no coming back. Now, there's way too many people that believe that because we have the right to bear arms, we can fight an armed revolution. But back in the days of the founders, back in our forefathers' days, a musket was a musket, a cannon was a cannon, and everybody had equality in projecting force. That's not the same today. The way of technology and the way, you know, these, I'll just say, government military capabilities surpasses what anybody can do at the neighborhood. Because why? We don't have the militias. We don't actually have people that got their name on a plane because as the militia, you're the pilot for the state, for that aircraft or what have you. You know, that actually belongs to somebody else, and it belongs to somebody that doesn't care about state sovereignty, doesn't care about anything other than the agenda. There may be people in the military that may actually have to make some tough decisions, say, I am not going to drop bombs on Denver. But there may be people that actually, and this is the problem, they've been programming and programming our kids for years. And once they get them to that point where the kids will be willing to drop, we're basically out of time, when the kids will actually be willing to drop bombs on us, then we will rue the day, because that's when they'll be able to take us off that lift and say, you can't jump off anymore. We've assumed control. And that kind of goes to an old Rush song, 2112. But anyway, I digress. Folks, we've got a lot more to go through. We're still going through Article 1, Section 10. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.